Yeah, those are great comments, Gus. I share a lot of those, and I guess the comment that I submitted in writing was along the lines of, again, of the pass-fail, that the idea that you can spend hundreds of thousands of professional hours on some of these large engagements on an annual basis and come back with a boilerplate opinion that's exactly the same, no matter whether, again, just as long as you're not going over the cliff, it's virtually exactly the same. And, you know, the firms, I don't think, are doing that to be obtuse. They're doing that because that's the standards they have to follow. I also think it's because of, again, the litigious environment we're in, that, you know, any time that they would get out of any kind of a comfort zone, they're putting themselves at great risk. So how do we solve for both of those? You know, the idea that there's a tremendous amount of knowledge and intellectual capital built up amongst the members of the audit team that could be shared in some fashion, but how do you protect them from the legal risk of, you know, a lot of the stuff is still judgmental. At the end of the day, their judgments could be off. Hopefully, they're not 180 degrees off. That, you know, they're somewhere in the 360 degree radius. That they're probably going to be 20 to 25 degrees of right or wrong. That's going to be a lot closer if they can kind of talk to us about that than if we just have to guess. So I'm mindful of the fact there are other organizations out there that provide their opinions on companies and their financial stability or their credit rating. So obviously the big credit rating agencies have a very finely graded type of or granulated type of grading system. So, you know, AAA, AAA minus, double, you know, BBB plus. So you go through what S&P, a Moody's, or a Fitch. You know, do we want to get something like that from the audit firms? Do we come up with, again, I like Gus's idea of maybe a little bit of a checklist of, you know, what are the kind of things, particularly the soft spots, the estimates, and, again, be able to get some color on not only what management's views were, how they're coming up with the estimates, but what's the auditor's judgment, you know, beyond a pass-fail of, did they, you know, just, again, pass? You know, what are the various gradations of pass and fail is so rare it's almost not even worth talking about because it's rare that, you know, anybody comes back and fails. It gets a qualified opinion. There's got to be something in between.
Yeah. That's very helpful. Lynn Turner.
I actually have a different view. I actually do like the pass-fail system. When I pick up a financial statement... when I pick up a set of financial statements, I want to know they're either right or wrong. I don't want to know that cash is right and receivables is okay, you know, and that when I get down to impairment of assets, it's like, oh God, who knows? So I think a pass-fail notion is a good notion, and I think it's the right way to go with the report. What I would then build on top of that, though, is what we discussed at the SAG, and that is something that has been labeled as an auditor's discussion or analysis of the numbers. And the things that Gus is asking for actually exist, because when we do an audit... at the end of the day, at the end of each audit, there is some type of summary memo prepared that goes on top of the binder that every single partner and the concurring partner and the audit manager have to sign off on. And what that memo does is it identifies the significant items that the auditor was concerned about that had risk. And any of us that have done those audits know exactly what memo we're talking about, okay? Now, if we knew that was going to become public, we might be a lot more careful how we write it or write it in a different context. But what you're asking for does exist. It's that summary memo that is in every single audit. And that's, in essence, what would go into an auditor's discussion and analysis. Part of what you're asking for, though, is also not an auditing issue. Part of what you're asking for deals with the FASB's disclosure standards. And the FASB's own investor technical advisory committee has urged the FASB to adopt a disclosure framework And that disclosure framework, if they would do it, would turn around and provide investors the key assumptions that go into these significant judgments and estimates. It would give you information about the range of possible outcomes and the key points that would drive, as well as what within that range was the number that the company picked. So if you still get a good number in the financial statement, what they think their best estimate was, but you get information in the footnotes about all the flavor and connotation around that so you can make estimates. You put that information together with then what's in that auditor memo, and I can guarantee you, you know exactly where the risks are in those financial statements, and you know exactly the information you need to dig down and analyze, and if you want to on your own move the numbers around, move them around. But that's what you're really getting, trying to get to. And trying to put all that just into the first pass-fail audit report, I don't think works. I think I want to be able to just right off the bat go and say, are my financials right or not? And then go get the additional analysis so I can analyze it as a analyst or researcher or investor. But I still want that pass-fail report in plain English.
Marty, do you want to take a minute or two and, or a couple of minutes and discuss what we're up to?
Sure. This is Marty Bauman, the Chief Auditor at the PCAOB. And this has been a great discussion, and thanks. It's a valuable input to us in our auditing standard-setting process. So let me just talk about a couple of the things that have been discussed. The first one was, should the individual auditor sign the audit report? And as was mentioned a couple of times, we've discussed that with the standing advisory group. We issued a concept release on that. And what's particularly helpful here, because as Steve said, the responses that came back to the concept release were largely from the profession and largely opposed to that concept of signing the report. Clearly the discussion around this table from this investor group is sees that that's a pretty good way for accountability on the part of the auditor, and would probably help the investor and may even help the auditor as well, as I think I heard somebody say. As we have a project underway in my office kind of pulling that sort of to its final conclusion right now, where we'll bring a paper to the board with our recommendation from the Office of the Chief Auditor as to how we should move ahead with that project on signing the audit report. And so the board should be getting that recommendation from my office pretty soon. And we've been doing a lot of, you know, research on that, and certainly this conversation and record helps that discussion. Turning to the audit report itself, and Lynn, thanks for summarizing most of what I was going to say, because you did a great job. We had a very good discussion of this at the very last meeting of the SAG, just a month or two back, and it was a recommendation of the Treasury Advisory Committee, and so we took this up and put a briefing paper before the SAG and had a pretty very, very thorough discussion, including breakout sessions of members of the SAG. And I think what Lynn said was held pretty widely by most of the group, that there is a great benefit to the single report that does say whether or not the financial statements present fairly, that making that ambiguous might not be very helpful to investors, and therefore retaining the report that indicates whether the financials present fairly or not is a positive thing, but yet the auditors want more. So, again, I have to come to a recommendation to the board, but in doing that, the way we're thinking about that is taking a look at, and pretty in line with the comments that Kelvin made initially, taking a look at the audit report itself, which would retain the presents fairly pass-fail type of model, but there's probably some things in the language of that report that could still be improved. And that might be a shorter-term project to deal with improving the language, which might deal with some of the responsibilities around fraud, as well as some of the other things you mentioned. What does reasonable assurance mean, and so on and so forth. So, but maybe staying with that report, improving that report and clarifying some of the language in it and improving it. And a potentially longer-term project, because it's not quite as simple to take a look at what Lynn called and what has been referred to by many people as the auditor's discussion and analysis, And we'll, again, we'll make a recommendation to the board on how to proceed, how we think, my office thinks we should proceed on this. But there are a lot of communications that are made to the audit committee as well of the type of nature that investors are asking for here, right here. The close calls, consultations with national office, the most complicated estimates and judgments, the controversial accounting policies, things of those that nature, that it really seems that investors are looking for that kind of information as well. Adding that supplementary auditor's discussion and analysis, I think, requires a lot more thought as to what that would look like, the standards around that, guidelines around that, et cetera. And we'll think of the best ways to try to address that, which, you know, could include focus groups and the like, to try to get further input on how that might be done. But that's been pretty consistent input in that regard. And I also agree that it's a project that probably needs to be coordinated to some extent with FASB, because a lot of this, when we're talking about measurement uncertainty, illiquid financial instruments, as an example, over the last couple of years, the ranges around those numbers can be quite large as to what the financial instrument's value is. And the actual departure around what was reported in the financial statement and potential ranges around that might actually equal what the auditor considers to be material. And so disclosure of that somewhere in the financial statements, so that investors understand that that number that they're looking at on the balance sheet might have a range around it that's equal to or greater than what the auditor considers to be material, might be very important. So those are the kinds of things that I think we've begun some conversations with Bob Herz. I sit on the disclosure framework project task force there, and I think there is an integrated effort as well. So we are tackling these issues on the auditor's report, and these comments have been very, very helpful. So thank you.
Try and finalize this panel in the next 10 minutes or so.
Mike Head, and my intent here is to kind of reinforce a few things that have been said from my perspective, is that I'm sort of where Lynn and the PC and Marty are, that I think it will cause confusion if you try to put a multi-page report in the 10K for the investor to look at as part of opining on the fair presentation of the financial statements and their accuracy. However, I do think the concept of an auditor discussion and analysis, like management's discussion and analysis, and having that as a section in the 10K could add a lot of value, and as we've already described, a roll-up that already is in place from it being the audit conclusion documentation that auditors have to put together, how that supports the mandatory communications to the audit committee that covers most of these items, not all of them. And then if you draw upon their planning report that they present at the beginning of the year to the audit committee most of them call it their integrated audit plan, and you take elements, all of this information already exists, and if there was a format of and required content that's dictated similar to management's discussion and analysis, that would be the auditor's discussion and analysis, that the firm would have to sign a consent like they do the opinion, I think you add some real value and not create more audit work or cost to the audit, because it all already exists and has to be reported in some form or fashion to the audit committees today. It's just a matter of what's important to the user and reader of the financial statements from the PCAOB's and SEC's opinion. So, I think that's a very, very positive direction to go, that is where I think a lot of the dialogue today has been at.
Just very quickly, while certainly...
Ann Yerger, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is Ann Yerger. Certainly the council believes the disclosure about the auditing process would be of interest. We do believe that more details about key findings would be of particular benefit to the investing public. I'm aware that you've released a proposal regarding enhanced disclosures between the audit firms and the audit committees, and our view at the council is that some of those disclosures would be of keen interest to the investing public, and it seems like some of your work is already being done in this area, and thus I think it would get at some of the issues you were talking about, which I agree are very, very important.
Sorry, because Meredith, you had yours up first. We're just going in order. It's Anne Simpson at CalPERS. We're fully in support of more commentary.
Anne Simpson?
Yes.
I'm just identify yourselves as you go around because there's a larger audience.
Right, thank you. I am Anne Simpson. one caveat, if the discussion is to be more than just more fluff, is this issue about potential liability litigation, and I don't know, well, maybe we just leave it on the table for coming back to discussion, is about what do we need by way of safe harbor provisions. So confidentiality is not quite the confessional confidentiality between the auditor and the audit committee, but putting that out into the public markets puts it under the glare of publicity but also potential litigation, and I just wonder if it will continue to be so useful, so maybe we need to look at that. Thank you.
I'm not Ann Simpson. My name's Meredith Williams. I want to know how close I am to the cliff. I truly do. I want to know, on the accounting side, how hard the entity is pushing. Are they on the edge there as well? How hard are they leaning on the accounting standards? I don't get to sit in the boardroom. I certainly don't have time to call the head of the engagement, the audit partner, the top-level audit partner. But I got to know, and again, I don't know the right question to ask. Maybe my right question is, would you, head auditor, put your money in this firm? Would you buy stock in this company? I need some feel. I don't get that now. You know, the pass-fail thing is fine. That allows you in our gate, and we'll then put you through the rest of the analysis to decide whether we want to buy you or sell you. But so the pass-fail has some significant benefit, but I got to know more. I really like the idea of perhaps having some access to an auditor discussion analysis, so long as it includes some kind of a sensitivity analysis that others have referred to. In saying this is a going concern and so forth, what number are you using as your basis? What happens if things go askew in one direction or another? How thick is the ice? So those are my thoughts on these very important matters. Thank you.
Damon?
I have a couple of comments on this discussion. The first is, and I said this before at the SAG, I'll say it here, there are some very large issues that I think are now fairly clear in relationship to the sort of what did Lynn say, the sort of the reliability or the seriousness with which investors take audited financials in the audit process, and one of them has surfaced in our discussions today, and the other has not, and I just want to, it's important to put them on the record in this conversation, and then I want to shift to at least one type of response that one could imagine to this set of problems that often seems kind of intractable. The two problems that have surfaced, I think, in the last 24 months that are really very serious and unaddressed are, one, the issue that came up in relation to the foreign auditors and in relation to China, and the conversation ended, but I think I want to bring it back up here because it's relevant to this discussion. You know, Lynn asserted that essentially We have an audit process in China and perhaps in other countries that's simply not reliable and not likely to be fixed. Given the the degree of economic integration of the United States and U.S. public companies with China's economy. We're essentially, if that's true, and we've had, again, discussions at the Standing Advisory Group about this, if that is true, then that is a very serious problem for the integrity of our auditing process and our public company financial statements, because increasingly Chinese operations, directly and indirectly, are just integrally part of our corporate economy. The second problem that we have is not one we can blame on anybody else, and that is in relationship to our financial institutions. I serve on the oversight panel for TARP. In that context, our staff has tried to determine the extent of impaired assets in our public companies in the financial sector, particularly in the very large systemically significant banks. The question simply can't be answered. The nature of the way in which the audit firms, the issuers, and FASB have interacted over the last year or so has made this sort of fundamental question about our economy and about the health of these large firms unanswerable. These are post Sarbanes-Oxley issues that really raise sort of profound systemic doubts about what we're doing here. Now, as long as explicitly or implicitly, the American public is guaranteeing the financial solvency of those institutions, it's a little unclear exactly what that means for investors, but I'm not sure that's a comforting assurance. Now, with those two very large caveats, let's turn to the more ordinary course of what we've been just discussing. So we have this problem that we have a binary auditor's opinion, and one switches, you're fine, and the other switches, you're dead, effectively. Investors and the general public can sometimes find that unsatisfactory as a source of information. And there are two types of options that are often offered, and I think, at least I believe, that neither one of them will achieve much of anything. I think the idea of a multi-grade audit doesn't work, because everyone will turn out to be above average, the binary system will continue under another name. The second idea is that we give the auditors an opportunity to write a long essay about the company. I think we've all seen what those long essays turn into. Not much information in the end gets conveyed, because it's dangerous to everybody to do so. The only thing that might be more productive is I think we all know what we're trying to get at, which is that in the course of an audit, at some point, a handful of issues, hopefully, get identified as being problematic and sources of tension between the preparer and the preparer's financial staff and the auditor. And those issues get wrestled around with, and eventually, unless things are going unraveling very fast, eventually those issues get resolved and a clean audit letter is issued. I think what investors really want to know is, what are those issues? And as Lynn said, there's a memo that lists them that the audit firm has and that investors don't have. How would we surface those issues without surfacing everything? Because I'm not sure we want to surface everything. And I think there's a simple way to do it. I'm not sure anybody has the sort of the, as we were discussing at lunch, I'm not sure anyone has the guts to do it this way, but there's a simple way to do it, and that is to require that as part of the audit letter, that three or five, or you pick your number, material items be listed that were the subject that in the auditor's opinion are the most debatable aspects of the financial statement. That internal memo exists. If you had to list three or five or even one, it's hard to imagine how you avoid doing so, given that the internal memo exists and it can be checked against if things were to go badly. That would, bring those items out. I think investors would very much like to see what those items are. I haven't thought through, and I'm not certain exactly whether you could do that in a way that would maintain the current dynamics, the current behind-the-scenes dynamics, which in certain ways are helpful. It's you know, there is a value to the incentive process that the firm has resolving those items the way firms do currently, right? Obviously, if you meet the auditor's concern, then you don't have a problem. What I'm suggesting is a system in which there would be no way to avoid having to actually tell the public what the dodgy items were and how they were resolved. And I think this is more like that approach would be more likely to actually generate information than either a narrative or a graded final audit opinion. So anyway, I offer that for people's contemplation.
This is Norman Harrison. I'm actually tempted to just to take my sign down and pass because I think that was well said, Damon, and in fact it was. I will be brief because you said it much more succinctly, but I was going to make the broader point, and Damon's suggestion fits neatly into it. I think in many respects we are all talking about the same thing here, and whether it's a matter of whether we change the format of the report or we have an auditor's discussion and analysis, or at the end of the day what we're talking about is disclosure, and I'm not sure that the manner in which what we call it or where in the audit papers it comes is as important as what we're getting. And I think Damon has hit it. What we're concerned about is, in addition to things we've already discussed about how, you know, the independence determination was made at the threshold and how the engagement was staffed and planned, most importantly from the investor standpoint, what issues of concern came up along the way, and how did the auditor get comfortable? Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. It's about getting comfortable, putting your giving that grade, whatever it is, and signing that report. And I think that is the key disclosure that we're looking for here, and if perhaps that is a good suggestion. I think there would be some benefit from some further review by this group, but to use the conclusion memo, I mean, the management letter, there are documents prepared in the course of an audit that contain or highlight those issues and to distill those into some type of meaningful disclosure at the conclusion of the process that auditors, the investing public would have access to, I think would be a breakthrough. And so that's my final word. Thank you.
Tony? Thank you. This is Tony Sondi. There are about three or four points that I wanted to just go back to. One of the issues that was raised was how, you know, we'd like to know how far we are from the cliff. Unfortunately, you're often told that you're quite a distance from the cliff, and then there's a review at the national office level, and you discover that your audit partner was actually wrong, but you don't have any recourse anymore. You've got to fix that. The seemingly arbitrary nature of those types of decisions is something that investors would benefit understanding better. The other issue, though, is a little bit different, and I'm concerned that whether it's pass or fail or different type of grade, the problem is that it's still scorekeeping. That's what they're telling us. They're not giving us better information. It's unclear to me, to some extent, whether we're really wondering whether auditors ought to tell us a little bit more after analyzing the company. One of the things that I'll just very briefly tell you about, one of the ratios or analytical methods that I use a great deal is to look at what I call the cash cycle of a firm. Look at the number of days it has inventories on hand, add that to the number of days it takes to collect its receivables, and subtract from that the number of days it takes to pay its suppliers. I call that the cash cycle. It has been shown for the last several years to be a very, very good indicator of companies that are in trouble. Now, just imagine the amount of time it takes, and if it takes you about, you can find out about 2 to 3 years in advance, that means there was something seriously wrong with those numbers in the financial statements. When the day's sales outstanding continues to climb, is it not normal to expect that the analysis of uncollectibles should have been done a little bit differently? Well, that's one of the estimates that I'm assuming auditors are looking at. Another comment that was made was that there are some issues with respect to the estimation errors in fair value.
But what about the estimation errors and accruals? We've learned lately that there are tremendous estimation errors in the amount of liquidity that people report to. If you don't look at the option rate preferreds and the money markets with some care, you can certainly tell people, yeah, they've got this much in option rate preferreds, but we're not saying anything about whether you're going to collect them. When you look at it from that perspective, or you take the issue of whether the existence of off-balance sheet financing activities, the existence of special purpose entities or variable interest entities, is really an issue between the accounting standards, standard setters, and that, you know, between the PCAOB, my question is, the existence of such vehicles, such as special purpose entities and the variable interest entities, other off-balance sheet activities, they do suggest a certain amount of risk. The fact that we're not going to account for them doesn't eliminate the risk. So from that perspective, I think we need to look at this a little bit differently. Yes, there are errors in estimation. I served on the expert advisory panel on measurement of the fair value of illiquid securities. We did tell and we did come up with ways in which you would do a sensitivity analysis, and some of that now is part of the standards. The question is, you know, what should I expect the auditor to be able to tell me about these things, other than saying that somebody actually showed them a spreadsheet which had some of this analysis? Is completion of an analysis a sufficient audit process?
Bonnie Hill. I'd like to go back to something that Ann said that I think really goes to the heart of the matter of the disclosures or transparency, however we want to define it. And that has to do with public and non-public information. How much information, you know, is the company willing to share, or the auditor, because of the exposure that they have, you know, in the legal sense as well. And what comes to my mind is discussions we have in the boardroom or in the audit committee on materiality and what a particular, what our auditors thought and what our internal auditors and our finance people thought, and if there's a difference there, how they got to the place that they did. And we have those discussions. There are a lot of things that you'll discuss as it relates to the auditor's report, even before it's actually published, that are not things that you're necessarily going to shed the light on for the general public, because on a daily basis or a monthly basis or whatever the case may be, you'd have your stock price jerked around in some incredible fashion because people just don't know how it's going to come out when you're working through issues. I think when I talk about the transparency, I think the important thing is, what is the process that you use? How do you resolve discrepancies? And if there are serious issues, then I think, of course, those have to be disclosed. But, you know, from my experience, what happens is you go to a certain point, and the lawyers will say, that's non-public, and you can't disclose that. So, you know, as we move forward, and I think what we all agree on is very important, which is making certain that the investor knows what kind of risk they're taking. Those risks are being evaluated on almost a daily basis inside the company and inside the boardroom and with the auditors. And much of it you're just not going to get. You can get a longer report, and what it's going to say is, we've used this type of process to get to this place, and our conclusion is thus. And I just don't think you're going to get the detailed, you know, description of everything that takes place.
Well, Bonnie, Norman, and Kelvin, thank you very much for leading that discussion, that panel. Why don't we take a 15-minute break until 4:15, and then we'll be back and conclude by 5 o'clock. Okay, why don't we get started with our next panel, which is Audit Expertise and Responsibilities. And Charlie, why don't you go ahead and introduce the panel?
Okay, thank you, Steve. I think it's appropriate that our last session with a designated subject matter is kind of wide-ranging. Auditor expertise and responsibilities. Certainly we've heard some comments that go from auditor's level of knowledge of complicated financial instruments, certainly knowledge of accounting standards, and accounting standards, especially in an environment in which there is a great promise of some fairly drastic changes in the accounting standards, disclosures, issues related to whether to include references to the internal audit function in the auditing standards, as well as adding a forensic audit component to the standard audit process. To lead us off, Robert Tirola will start, and then Tony Santi, and then last but not least, Judge Sporkin. Gentlemen's yours.
Thank you, Charlie. Bob Tirola speaking. I want to take the group down memory lane. Those of you with gray hair, and there's a few of us in the room. 30 years ago, companies produced financial statements, and auditors provided an opinion on those financial statements, and that was basically the financial reporting that investors received. Move forward a little bit. Management's discussion and analysis was required. I'm going to guess in the late 70s, and the auditors reported on the financial statements. And then more disclosures were requested around risks and exposures, and auditors reported on the financial statements. And then more disclosures around compensation and enterprise risk management, and auditors reported on the financial statements. The point I'm trying to make here is that companies are producing comprehensive reports about their business, about how they're managing their business, about how they're compensating executives, their philosophies around risk mitigation. But the auditors are looking at the financial statements. From my perspective, anyway, that's a far too limited role for auditors in helping investors. That they touch every page of those reports, whether it's a 10K, a 10Q, or a proxy, yet their responsibility is to the narrow part of it called financial statements. I've been an auditor, and I've worked with auditors as a CFO and as an audit committee member, and they crawl all over the company. They know whether or not the disclosures about the business are fair and reasonable. They assess whether or not the measurements for executive compensation are correct and accurate. Yet we don't call upon them to make any sort of comment about the larger aspect of the company's financial report. We limit their role to the financial statements. I believe the PCAOB has the ability to expand the role of the auditor to more than just the financial statements. I think investors would be well served if there was a type of validation that was applied to the entire company report by the auditor, not just the financial statements themselves, not even, again, going to the discussion of the financial statements. So our panel is to talk about auditors' responsibilities and the expertise to carry out those responsibilities. If the role of the auditor was to expand beyond the financial statements, it's going to take a different expertise, and I'm going to let Tony pick up on that. But as an investor, when I think about either myself personally or my role in investment companies, what the market really wants is a validation of the value factors in the marketplace. Wants a validation of whether or not market risk is fairly assessed. So what role could the auditor play in helping the market get comfortable with the elements of valuation, whether it's integrity of management, whether it's ability to continue to grow, whether it's the prospect of a new product, whatever factors may be in the marketplace that are generally discussed in company reports, what role should the auditor play in helping validate the broad-based information in the marketplace, not just the financial statements? And then, Tony, what expertise would they need?
Thank you, Bob. This is Tony Sonley. I'm going to talk about three specific areas. Disclosures, because that's what, as an analyst, that's what I always focus on. Securitizations, off-balance sheet activities, and derivatives. Now, with respect to disclosures, you know, those of you, and all of us here, of course, have read footnotes and or financial statements, and we know that at the bottom of the page, every one of them, every page, it says these footnotes are an integral part of the financial statements. But for the 10 years that I've been on the standard-setting bodies, one of the first things I remember telling the EITF the day I joined them was that it seems as if there are two laws that we operate by. One is that we don't talk about accounting after 4 p.m. on Fridays. And there's a corollary to that, that we never discuss disclosures before 4:30 p.m. on Fridays. And, you know, so if you go back and take a look at the EITFs, you'll discover it. You go back 6 years, you will find that so many of them don't have disclosure requirements. And I don't understand that. They're supposed to be accounting standards. Think about one of the biggest changes that we've had in recent years, the accounting standard on stock options. When 123R became required, a lot of companies discovered that they didn't have enough information to calculate certain deferred taxes. However, they were supposed to have been doing that for 10 years at that point. And they all had audits for 10 years at that point, and yet they didn't know anything about their deferred or sufficient information about their deferred tax assets. Now, that's just, you know, in a sense, one example. We have more than 100 accounting standards on revenue recognition. There are a few components of financial reporting that are as poorly served by disclosures as revenue recognition. EITF 0021, which talks about multiple element arrangements. We used to have two requirements which are fundamentally just descriptive. Every one of the accounting firms that's writing about the replacement, the amendment of 0021, EITF 081, starts off by saying there's going to be a tremendous expansion in your disclosure requirements, which the way I see it, now you're actually going to have to talk about what you were doing. So in that sense, disclosures, I think, have been unfortunately neglected. And I don't understand why auditors don't audit the disclosures to the extent that I believe they should. Securitizations, the other off-balance sheet activities. As I said, those accounting transactions, there may be to some extent problems with our accounting standards, special purpose entities, the QSPEs, for example, which we've finally gotten rid of. But the point is that there is a substantive amount of risk that remains on the books. You don't find a lot of companies actually selling those kinds of assets. However, we created an accounting standard that permits the recognition of a sale transaction. Lawyers give true sale opinions, and they give the consolidation opinions. But you could ask one lawyer or two lawyers or three lawyers, and you'd get a ton of different explanations of what a true sale means. They're not fundamentally either economic or accounting concepts. And yet they've informed our financial statements extremely poorly, I would say, over the years. Consider the disclosures and derivatives. Do you really think that it's rational to expect a company that engages in several billion dollars of trading in derivatives to tell you that an X percent increase on either side in either the interest rate or the foreign exchange risk is not going to cause us any losses? How many people do you know who are perfect with respect to derivatives? And yet, if I read disclosure, they were not going to have any losses as a result of those derivatives. And yet, we have these disclosures that are sent to us over and over again with clean opinions. I'll give you just as the last point. This is sort of eerily reminiscent to me, at least, of Repo 105 transactions, which most of you are probably aware of. A few years ago, 1999 to be exact, a company made the following disclosure. And I'm just going to tell you two sentences in it. Year end was September 30. On the 10th of September, the company created a finance subsidiary and sold its $600 million of receivables. And the finance subsidiary is 100% owned. And the company, in order to make that sale, set aside $750 million in collateral. Now, what do you think? Do you think a sale occurs for $600 million if you have to put up $750 as collateral? But it gets better. The next line. In October, we repurchased all the receivables and shut down the subsidiary. And this was treated as a sale. It's not all that different from Repo 105. But, you know, I don't want to hold them out as the only company that does that. There are a lot of financial institutions that have been engaging in that game. And there are lots of companies that we don't think of as financial institutions that have also played that game. So the point, I think, is, from my perspective, we need a better understanding of disclosures on the part of the auditors. We need them to review them. When you open up the Dow 30, for example, and look for the derivative disclosures, and for the Dow 30 you find that the derivative disclosures in those 30 companies read identically, there's got to be something wrong. These are boilerplate disclosures. How can Exxon possibly be telling you the same thing as GE? And how can an airline have the same wording for a disclosure requirement as a metals company? So in that sense, we need a better understanding of what these financial statements are supposedly telling investors.
Terrific stuff, but let me go back a little bit to basics here. While I might hold the accountants, give them a little tough love, it shouldn't denigrate my view of the accounting profession. And I think that was shown when we created the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the late 70s. And I must tell you, it was based upon the great esteem we had for the accounting profession, because it was thought when the books and records provisions would be put in, that was done so the accountants would find all the schmutz and be able to disclose it. But let us now talk about, we sort of have to differentiate some of the things we're talking about today, separate the apples from the oranges. The first thing that we expect the accounting profession to do is mine the data. They have to find the data. The second thing is, when they find the data, what are they going to do with it? And so there are two big issues that come along that challenge the accounting profession. In other words, if they mine the data and they don't find what's going on, then obviously they're not going to be able to issue the kind of report that's necessary. And talking about mining the data, something has cropped up over the years in which the accounting profession says, well, we're going to mine it, but we're only going to be looking for material kinds of things, little stuff we're not going to look at. And so, therefore, the people on the other side that's trying to defeat the system, and remember there's a tension that's taking place here, people trying to defeat the system, at the same time you have the profession that's and the good guys that are trying to make sure that it's working. And so we have that so the people who are trying to defeat the system have learned exactly the way the accounting profession works. And so we developed the so-called financial audit. And the financial audit, as I told you before, is looking for big things, looking for materiality. Now comes fraud. And the accounting profession says, well, we don't, it used to say, it's changed a little bit, we're not looking for fraud. And to bolster that, the people that are trying to defeat the system, they understand that, and so they go under the radar screen. and they mine, they go out and deal with the system so that they can beat it. For example, if you're trying to bribe somebody and you don't want to put, and you don't want the accountants to find it, you do it by doing the kinds of things in the accounts that they don't look at. Petty cash account. We don't want to get into petty cash. It's too small. And yet, the people defeating the system use it to get the money to pay the bribes. And they do it all the time. So, the first thing you got to do is devise the system so that the accounting profession is now going to be looking at that aspect of it. And what is the thing that I had to come up with this concept in connection with a client? And so what we did with the client, which is an accounting firm, what we did with the client, we said, okay, wouldn't it be nice to combine forensic accounting with a financial audit? Bring the two together. So the forensics will look for the under the radar screen, and the financial audit will go into their dance with respect to the materiality. This works. We've had one season where we did it. It's good, and now we're going back to the second season. And I can say to you, it will work. And I think hopefully it will become packaged and become maybe a part of the whole system. I don't see any reason why that kind of concept can't work. Second thing that I find when I look at the accounting profession. Now remember, I have I was trained as a CPA, so I have a little accounting background. Second thing I found, which I think is quite interesting, is the fact that when the SEC looks at a transaction, is different than when the accounting profession looks at a transaction. Why, I don't know, but it's like night and day sometimes. And so the concept there that I'm trying to develop is the concept of a compliance component in an accounting firm that will look at the end of an audit, will go through the audit and look at the items based upon now, we have a history now of so many things involved in the in trying to defeat the system that they will know fully what they are, whether it's the 105s or the each time we get another one of these these things, such as the 105s or the special purpose entities, to build information concerning them. Have this person who's highly trained in this area to look at the audit, step back, and say, wait a second, what is it that does this audit show any of these items? And if so, to be able to see how they were dealt with. And so that's something that I think is important. Now, the other area, remember I talked about mining, getting the information, bubbling it up, getting it up to the top. The second area now is how does the accountant handle this? Accountant now knows, let's assume my system works, he now knows what the problems are, and now we get back to, I guess it was Turner's point, what I used to call the exception list that the accountants have at the end of the audit, and to take up and sort of getting in a negotiation with the company. And here we have the same problem we were talking about today. Does the accountant have the fortitude to be able to stand up to the company and tell them that with respect to these items, they've got to be dealt with right? I remember I had one case where an old fellow named Bluedorn, I don't know if that name means anything to anybody anymore, but he had an asset on Gulf and Western. It was $28 million. In those days, millions meant something. In a company that was kaput. And so he came up with a scheme that the company invested in sugar plantations. So he went around and he was buying sugar plantations, and what he would do is he would give them cash and some of the kaput company and say, okay, I'll pay you $5 million plus I'll give you $2 million of this kaput company. And so he was able through this way of buying a number of this to take off completely the bad asset and it then went into the sugar plantations where nobody would ever know about it. In any event, as property went up in value, it would mask what they were doing. And I remember calling in the head of the audit firm because we were ready to take action, and the fellow was quite candid. He said to me, Stan, he said, let me tell you something. At the end of the audit, we had five items. We sat down with management, and you know what? We won on four of them, 80%. He says, that's not a bad percentage, and therefore we had to give him this one. And, you know, you know, I had to tell him that 80% might be good in certain things, but it isn't good in accounting. And so, therefore, how do you get the profession and the accounting firm to be stand up and say, look, no, we're not going to stand for it. We're going to go for the 100%. We saw today where we're talking about this business of the foreign auditor. And, you know, it's nothing. It's common for people to be worrying about other people's concerns. And I've learned through my many, many years that once you compromise your principles and say, well, it might not be that bad, it's a prescription for disaster. It happened with the SEC and the Madoff case. It happens all the time. And so how do you inspire or get the accounting profession? And this is, to me, I think, is a core issue, that once they have to make a decision that's tough on their client, for them to say, yeah, that they're going to go through with it. That, I think, is really the core issue. The mining can be taken care of, as I told you about the combination. But the real problem is once they know about it. This is not something that's they don't know about. But once they know about it, to be able to carry through and tell the client that, no, they cannot do what they want to do. And I don't know what how you get, other than by getting people like the PCAOB, when they find it, to be able to say, folks, you're going to get, it's going to cost you. And I think that's where we got to do. So that's my sermon for the day. Charlie, what do you think?
You're my hero, Stanley.